In the coming week, the proxy war between Iran and the United States intensifies. Sudan's conflict suffers another diplomatic setback, and the year's first big movie event, the Sundance Film Festival, takes place. It's January 18th, 2024, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Carlanne Robbins.
Carla, we're going to have to start in the Middle East again, as looks like it'll be the pattern for the year. We are more than 100 days now into the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. Fears of a region-wide spread of conflict continue to grow. U.S. forces have maintained attacks on Iran-aligned Houthis based in Yemen, and U.S. officials recently found evidence that implicates Iran in supplying Houthis with weaponry. This is only going to add to the tensions between the United States and Iran in and around the region. So, Carla, can you give us a sense of what we know about Iran's involvement in the potentially widening war?
This proxy war between Iran and the U.S. and its allies has been going on for years, as you know, Bob. And Iran, of course, is a main backer of Hamas and Hezbollah in Lebanon. It also backs the Houthis in Yemen, as well as Iranian-linked groups, which have been targeting U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria. But the fighting has gotten a lot more intense since the start of the Gaza war. At the same time, you know, all sides look like they're trying to avoid a direct confrontation. It's also not clear that that's possible to avoid, especially in a multi-front war. And this really is a multi-front war and a time when passions are so intense. And adding to the tensions, and this really is a surprise, in the last few days, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard has gotten directly involved. They've launched missiles against sites in Syria and Pakistan and Iraq. And these are all countries with which it's somewhat allied. And these, it said, were retaliation for recent terrorist attacks inside of Iran that killed 11 security personnel in Sistan, Balochistan in December. And you remember that terrible attack at a memorial march that killed 82 people this month. You know, these countries are allies, varying degrees of warmth. The Iraqis and Pakistanis in particular were not happy, and Pakistan hit back. At the same time, Pakistan itself referred to Iran as a brotherly country. So I think everybody wants to avoid it spinning out of control, but it is spinning. So all of this is, you know, proxy wars and a little bit of a direct war that is beginning there. So the proxies that are getting the most attention, as you mentioned, are the Houthis. You know, they've launched some 36 attacks since November on shipping in the Red Sea, saying they're acting in solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza. And starting last week, the Brits and the Americans began hitting Houthi military sites. I think there have been some 60 hits so far against missile launchers, air defenses, depots where they store missiles and drones, a few command centers. But the Houthis appear undaunted. In the last few days, they've hit a Greek-owned commercial ship and two U.S. commercial ships. In all three cases, no one was hurt, and the damage was reported to be limited. But for all of the hitting back, Houthis don't seem like they want to stop. Iran definitely involved. Missiles are very expensive. Drones are cheap, but missiles are expensive. And Yemen is a very poor country, so the Houthis couldn't be doing this without Iranian support. And late Thursday last week, the U.S. Navy SEALs boarded a sailing ship off the coast of Somalia. And according to the Pentagon, they seized components for Iranian-made cruise and ballistic missiles, which were bound for the Houthis in Yemen. And tragically, two SEALs are missing after the operation, but it's pretty, you know, strong proof of what Iran is doing.
So there's a ton going on there. And as you were talking, I'm thinking about if there was a heat map of the area, you'd see throbbing red all over the place. It's just getting worse and worse. But let's maybe start with the Houthis. You know, they dealt with a good amount of attacks from the Saudis in recent years, and it seemed like they shrugged that off pretty successfully. Saudis, by the way, using, in many cases, U.S. armaments to try to attack the Houthis. They have this lock on this one part of Yemen. So is the U.S. going to be content to continue to be attacking from afar? Is it going to have to ramp things up against them? Just on the Houthi front, are you seeing any signs of that?
Well, you know, the U.S. held off for a long time. I mean, I think they've got multiple equities here. Nobody really wants to make the situation inside of Yemen worse. One of the reasons why the Biden administration took the Houthis off of the terrorist list, which they've now put them back on, but not as intensely, was because they wanted to be able to get aid inside of Yemen. And nobody wants to make the situation in Yemen even worse. At the same time, what the Houthis are doing is really messing up, you know, the global supply chains. So there's a lot of equities involved there. The Houthis seem completely undeterrable. But, you know, missiles are very expensive, as I said, and they won't have an infinite number of them. And if you can stop the source, if you can stop the Iranians from shipping them, maybe pressure on Iran in other ways, drones are cheap. And the Houthis apparently have a capability of putting them together themselves, getting components from the Chinese and other places. So whether this is going to be a cat and mouse game or a bigger fight, you know, we'll just have to watch and see.
I wonder how much the Iranians can sustain this, because as you're saying, you know, there seems to be a desire to not escalate. Certainly their sway over Hezbollah seems to be such that Hezbollah is not going to escalate in response to some recent Israeli attacks in Lebanon. But there's the supplies to the Houthis, and then there's the Iranians reacting to attacks on their own soil. It just seems like they've got some problems on their own in terms of who's calling the shots and who's able to kind of direct things, but they're not necessarily the puppet master that we have in previous years thought of the Iranians as being in the region, at least.
Well, I think they have different levels of relationships and different levels of control. I'm certainly not an expert in these relationships, but the things that I've read and the things I've heard is that they have really limited control with the Houthis and much more direct relationship with Hezbollah. But U.S. officials believe that not only are the Iranians supplying missiles, but the Iranian ships and aircraft are giving targeting data to the Houthis. These are things that they could cut off, even if they may not be able to persuade them to stop doing what they're doing. So it seems like there's more of a choke point. You know, these attacks in Pakistan and Iraq and in Syria, these are things that are separate. This is a response to terrorist attacks that have taken place inside of Iran that happen to be taking place at the same time, but I think are quite separate from the Gaza war. And I think they, if anything, give the Iranians more of an incentive to try to crank things back in other places. Certainly, they have hit back hard because to send to their own hardliner messages or their own hardliners domestically and to send messages internationally. We have strong missiles. We are a strong country. We're not going to put up with this. At the same time, stability is all for them domestically. They don't want to show any weakness, but they also don't want things to spin any more out of control. They haven't forgotten that there were demonstrations in the street. They haven't forgotten that they have a very weak economy. So they are also, you know, walking, you know, to use a cliche, they're walking a very tough tightrope here.
And meanwhile, the core of the fighting is in Gaza. Some signs that the Israelis may be drawing down some of their forces. And you heard some new language from the U.S. administration in Davos this week about, you know, reiterating a call for a two-state solution. Are we getting any sense that the U.S. is trying to kind of bring together countries in the region to try to build some momentum on that front, let's say, at some sort of an effort of involving the Arab world and helping to kind of usher into a post-Gaza war phase? Or is that just too remote a prospect?
Certainly what the administration would like, but I think as long as the reality of the horrors of what's going on in Gaza continue, and certainly the U.S. seems to have minimal influence, if any at all, with the Netanyahu government. I mean, until this war winds down or ends, I just don't see a lot of progress there. And I find it really hard to imagine there's going to be any progress as long as Netanyahu stays in charge of Israel. So that's probably not a reality that the administration wants to voice out loud, but I suspect it's a reality they know.
And meanwhile, one of the other subplots going on is that Hamas still holds a number of hostages, more than 100 at this point. And it's not clear whether there's any sort of process that is going to get more of them released anytime soon.
You know, there was some progress this week, supposedly, to get more aid in to help the hostages, supposedly. But there doesn't seem to be any progress at all on this question of releasing hostages, which is also an essential domestic issue for Netanyahu. But as much as they talk about, you know, moving things back, you know, pulling people out, supposedly responding to what the Americans are saying, more targeted form of war, you know, they're going to go after leaders and not the general population. You still have these thousands and thousands of people who've been killed and all of these people who have been displaced in a terrible, terrible humanitarian situation and the constant warning of famine inside of Gaza. That's the reality. Very hard to talk about a two-state solution when the horror of what's unfolding in Gaza is continuing.
And I should note, we've just published on our website a primer on the Palestinian governance issue, such as it is right now, and how complicated a thicket that is and was before October 7th, and really raising questions about what sort of Palestinian entity could possibly emerge, you know, in any sort of time frame that lessens the tensions in the area.
Well, listen, responsible statecraft, one would hope that the State Department and the administration is thinking about what happens afterwards. and considering what governance is going to look like afterwards. It would be irresponsible not to do it, but I think the reality of it is that the war has to end. So Bob, let's shift to what I would hope would be a happier topic, but it's not. Let's shift to Sudan and the conflict between the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces, the SAF and the RSF, which began in April of last year, entered its ninth month on Monday. And more than 7.4 million Sudanese people have been displaced since this fighting began. And about 25 million people, 14 million of whom are children, are in desperate need of humanitarian assistance. Is anything being done to mitigate this crisis? And can the Sudanese people turn to anybody for help?
Well, we had entered this year with some little glimmer of potentially diplomatic momentum, Carlin. And in fact, today, Thursday, was supposed to be a day for a new round of diplomacy convened by this regional group in East Africa known as IGAD, I-G-A-D, that was going to bring together the heads of the two warring sides, the leader of the RSF, or the Rapid Support Forces, known as Hemeti, as well as General Al-Burhan, who heads up the military-led vestiges of the government in Sudan. But the government, the foreign ministry that is under the sway of the military, stepped up just a few days ago and said, this cannot happen. This is a violation of the sovereignty of Sudan to even invite this dangerous, you know, leader of the RSF. And so it seemed to have been an effort towards getting the principal two protagonists in the room together with a regional body convening talks on it. First of all, a ceasefire and then some sort of path and some sort of off-ramp to the fighting has instead devolved. And we're left with a situation in which Sudan gets worse and worse. And what a number of watchers of Sudan have said is that, first of all, back to your question, Carla, there's a problem of neglect going on. And let's face it, with the Middle East alone, what you were just talking about, that's occupying full tilt a lot of certainly major powers as well as countries in the region. But Sudan is, for the reasons you cited and the numbers you cited, is bad and getting much, much worse. So 600,000 people just in the past month have been displaced. And that adds to overall figures of 7.4 million displaced, which is a good 6 million of those are within the country. Almost 1.5 million have fled the country. That has regional impacts, obviously. Very precarious humanitarian situation and a growing sense of lawlessness in the country. I mean, the RSF forces have been steadily advancing, actually. There was a thought that Sudan might settle into a Libya-type situation where you have this regional division of almost half the country, and it's kind of a bit of a stalemate, and then things kind of muddle ahead. But in fact, the RSF forces are gaining ground. They've captured, in the last several weeks, the second largest city in the country after Khartoum. That's in the eastern part of the country, which had been under the sway of the military. The eastern and central part of the country is where most of the food is grown in Sudan, further raising alarm about what's going on there. The RSF forces have this pattern of when they take over an area, they practice sort of the longstanding raping and pillaging, literally, that we've seen through the ages. There's ethnic cleansing that goes on, and the thought of the RSF gaining a sway over most of the country really sends chills through Sudanese because they have antagonized the population. It's hard to imagine them running it, you know, even sort of Taliban style. And so it's not clear, you know, like, what are the options here? The peace process I mentioned through this Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, that again was seen as this new effort in addition to what had been the Saudi-U.S. effort known as the Jeddah process to try to get something going. You have to have the principals willing to step up and sit down and talk and agree on an agenda for starters. That's not happening. And the humanitarian situation gets worse. The UN says a pittance of its humanitarian appeal for Sudan has been answered so far. And so this is a country facing severe food shortages, if not famine. It's got a population in flight. It's got a population preyed upon by combatants. And it's got a world preoccupied with other matters that's not spending enough time focusing on it. Our colleague Michelle Gavin had posted about not only is the Sudan situation devolving and requiring more attention, but Eastern Africa in general is in a bad way right now. You'd have an unexpected new tensions between Somalia and Ethiopia over an Ethiopian move to work with the breakaway Somaliland region for coastal access. And so the problems go on, and the solutions seem to be few, and the will to kind of reach an agreement seems to be receding. So it's a large chunk of Eastern Africa. Sudan, let's not forget, also borders the Red Sea, which we had just spoken about. And so Port Sudan is still under the control of the government forces, of the military forces, I should say. But it's not clear how much longer that's going to be the case as well. So not a lot of options at the moment other than some sort of international pressure to try to open up humanitarian corridors, Carla.
So what international pressure is there? I mean,
there have been U.S. efforts to sanction chief officials involved in the conflict. Sanctions only go so far, as we know, as we've talked about in many other contexts as well. Again, our colleague Michelle Gavin has pointed to the fact that United Arab Emirates, which is a prime backer of the RSF forces, really needs to be called to account for its role in Sudan, for really sustaining this and playing basically what she says is a malign role in this all. So maybe it's influencing the influencers in this case, maybe the U.S. working on the UAE in some way to lessen its support. It's not clear to what extent and to what leverage the U.S. has in that regard, but there seems to be a sense that the U.S. can do more, and it has an official that's in the region that's been trying to work diplomatic angles, but the diplomatic angles aren't going anywhere, and it seems like it's more leverage is needed to come to bear. And that's, what does that mean? That sanctions tends to be the first option and a little bit of military show of force. The military is dealing with a few other things in the Red Sea at the moment.
So not for today, but I think we clearly need to take a closer look at the role the UAE is playing in all these different conflicts, because every time you look around, there they are. We're either condemning them or relying on them, and their role is quite confusing to me. So let's mark that as something that we should be digging into.
It bears closer look, certainly, Carla. Carla, I will be moving us on to a lighter topic, however, in the week ahead, because as listeners might know, you and I have a thing for films and film festivals and international films. And lo and behold, the Sundance Film Festival is going to be marking its 40th anniversary, which really is remarkable. I recall there was this thing that used to happen and Robert Redford would invite a few friends and they'd show some movies in the Rockies. And
a few thousand friends, yeah.
A few thousand of his closest friends. And you'd get some indie movies would emerge from it. And it's had a remarkable staying power. It's become a very important festival, Carla. But can you tell us what sort of films we need to be looking out for at this point in time, 2024?
So this is billed as the largest independent film festival in the U.S., though independent's a relative term. You know, it's filled with Hollywood insiders there, along with newcomers vying for insider attention. And the name, of course, is after Robert Redford's character in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Redford has been the sponsor from the beginning, as well, along with his Sundance Institute. And then in that time, it's brought attention to a lot of what were small films that made it big. Like, I went and looked at the list and just pulled out some of the ones that really, you know, I like: Garden State, American Psycho, El Mariachi, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Little Miss Sunshine, Thank You for Smoking, Napoleon Dynamite, and Whiplash, which was voted number one in the festival's list of top 10 films that made it big there. This is going to be the first in-person festival since the start of the pandemic, and there's also going to be online showing of most, but not all, of the films. And there are a host of differing must-watch lists out there, which we have been poring over, and sometimes this gig really is fun for us. So let's start with the foreign films and competition, because we're supposed to be looking at foreign things in this podcast. Brief History of a Family. I don't know a lot about Chinese movie making, so that drew my attention. It takes a look at the post one child policy China, and a family takes in their single son. They only have one child, new friend, to whom he, quote, feels a mysterious energetic pull, and hidden family tensions surface. Couldn't find a trailer for that, so that's all I could see about it. But as I said, I'm intrigued by the idea of Chinese cinema. There's something called Suho, which is the story of the son of a Mexican cartel hitman who's orphaned at the age of four. And it looks at all the different stages of his life and raises the question of whether he can escape his own father's violent destiny. And then there's Saoirse Ronan, who's something called The Outrun. She plays a recovering alcoholic who comes home to the Orkney Islands in an attempt to get herself back together. And Ronan's last movie at Sundance was Brooklyn, which won her an Oscar the following year. So, you know, I'll watch Saoirse Ronan in pretty much anything. So I think on the list of that, oh yeah, there's one more. I am a Nordic noir freak, so I might sign on to this, although I did find a trailer for this one and it really looks creepy, and that's called Handling the Undead. It's a Norwegian movie.
So Nordic noir that looks creepy, Carla? I'm shocked.
this is even creepier.
Okay.
And this tells the story of three families with recently deceased members who suddenly return to life. And it stars Renata Rensvi and Anders Danielsson Lee from The Worst Person in the World. So those are the ones that sort of drew my attention. On the domestic front, there's one very strange one that's getting a lot of buzz, something called Love Me. This is a sci-fi film, and it's about a satellite and a buoy who, long after humans have gone extinct, meet online and fall in love over web data, social media, and online videos. And the satellite, I believe, is played by Kristen Stewart, so she's always an indie favorite. There's also something called Exhibiting Forgiveness, which is directed by the painter Titus Kaphar, and it's a story about a Black artist whose life threatens to be completely knocked off course by the arrival of his father, who's a recovering addict who wants to reconcile. And this has a hugely strong cast. It's got Andre Holland, who played Kevin in Moonlight, and Andra Day, the R&B and soul singer, and Ingenue Ellis Taylor, you know, from When They See Us and Lovecraft Country, so just for the cast itself, as well as this extraordinary painter, Titus Kaphar, in his first feature film, Direction. That looks like one that definitely I want to see. You know, A Real Pain, which is also in the U.S. Dramatic Competition, which is directed by Jesse Eisenberg, and it also stars, along with Eisenberg, Kieran Culkin of Succession fame. And the two of them play mismatched cousins who take a road trip across Poland to explore the history of their family, which fled Europe to escape the Holocaust. To a certain extent, it does track Jesse Eisenberg's family. And it bills itself as both a comedy and a drama, which seems like a very challenging balance given the topic. And finally, there's a documentary going to my Argentine fascination called Gaucho Gaucho. And it's a documentary of Argentinian cowboys and cowgirls, which I think I'm probably going to want to see.
Wow, that's quite a lineup. Definitely piqued my interest. Also, I'm struck by, you know, as we continue to dig in every week on the perilous geopolitical and democratic moment that we're all in, these are real departures. These are real, like, ways of sort of taking yourself off the grid and just getting caught up in things, as you say, like Nordic noir, family dramas from China, or other kind of personal tales. It's an interesting rundown. It's an interesting cross-section of sort of experiences to kind of get lost in, which also matter, obviously, in life, but tends to get lost in the midst of all the geopolitics and war and everything.
Well, I will say that there are no rom-coms on this list here. So no Barbie either. But it is exciting to see just the variety of things that are brought. And you do know that everybody's going to be out there in Utah making big deals while dressed in their, I don't know, do people still wear fur?
Faux fur, Carla, faux fur.
Out there making their deals. So, Bob, it's time to discuss our audience figure of the week. And this is the figure listeners vote on every Tuesday and Wednesday at CFR_org's Instagram story. And this week, our audience selected 11 nations recognize Taiwan while Nauru cuts ties. Why did Nauru bail? And does it matter that Taiwan now only has official relations with 11 countries around the world?
Yes, and somewhat. We should note that when last we discussed Taiwan, we were talking ahead of the elections, which went off successfully. More than 70% turnout, which is really strong and puts countries like the U.S. to shame in terms of our typical turnout. But also, it was, as we discussed, it was a robust three-person race for president. There was also legislative races. And William Lai, as expected, won. And while his party was not able to achieve a majority, it's going to have to work with other parties to sort of pass some tough policies and things, which is in itself a balancing for the country. China was still pretty alarmed at the result and took, I think, great solace in Nauru's decision to unrecognize Taiwan. This is part of an ongoing effort by China to pick off all of the countries that recognize Taiwan, and in so doing, once and for all, completely isolate Taiwan and continue what it hopes is a inevitable, inexorable path towards unification with the mainland. China's response has been somewhat guarded since the results, but it was quick to lash out at countries that were supportive of Taiwan, including the U.S., which in its response stressed it did not recognize Taiwanese independence, but nonetheless congratulated Mr. Lai on his victory. But also you had, as our colleague Josh Kerlanka pointed out on CFR.org, you had countries like Japan and the Philippines with pretty strong, robust notes of congratulations to the DPP candidate for winning, which brought an immediate rebuke from Beijing. And again, pointed out the concern that China has over any sort of consideration of Taiwan as this separate entity, especially a thriving democratic separate entity so close to the mainland. Just the last couple of days, the first major Chinese military activity took place. Taiwan's officials said that something like 18 Chinese Air Force planes operating around Taiwan carried out what were called joint combat readiness patrols along with Chinese warships. So that's a reminder that China's sort of sending these messages that it's in the neighborhood and it's not going anywhere, and Taiwan needs to be careful. But as I said, the vote brought in the KMT, the party that China would rather do business with, was able to take 52 seats in the parliament, one more than the DPP. And the Taiwan People's Party, the TPP, took 8. So potentially there's a coalition there that can work together on legislation and potentially balance out DPP politics. We don't know. But in terms of the overall geopolitics, one fewer country where Taiwanese officials can feel safe and welcome to visit is not a good thing. We've also noted previously China has tried to remove Taiwan from any involvement in agencies like the WHO, which was a real setback for a number of reasons, including that Taiwan had lots to contribute to global health efforts, among other things. So geopolitics roaring back, interesting vote in Taiwan. Not sure whether it's going to raise the bar too much on tensions, though.
So just a few things. One, I just looked up the population of Nauru. It's 12,000.
Okay.
And one wonders what the Chinese offered Nauru to bail. You know, second, I think your point about the Philippines and Japan is a really interesting one, because much like the United States, you know, we don't have official relations with Taiwan. I think there are a lot of countries who are playing this game in which they may not have diplomatic ties with Taiwan. And I think the breaking of diplomatic ties does, you know, send a disheartening message to Taiwan. At the same time, I mean, I think that a lot of countries are still talking to Taiwan, and they're not as isolated as that 11 sounds like.
Yeah, that's a good point, Carl. I would also note some countries, former communist countries in Eastern Europe, Czech Republic, Lithuania, among others, have been very sort of straightforward in, you know, offering contacts and some bit of economic relations with Taiwan, I believe, which has enraged China. So you're right. I think it goes beyond just the official recognition, but it continues to be a goal of China to shorten that list of formerly recognized countries.
I mean, the Chinese do this all the time. It's like if you, you know, countries that invite in the Dalai Lama and then get, you know, whacked upside the head, and the Chinese, and certainly they're throwing their weight around in an enormous way at the UN. Also to places that we don't pay attention to, committees we don't pay attention to, meetings we don't show up at. Certainly the countries all over Latin America that complain, you know, that we're not showing up at meetings, you know, that we're almost AWOL. And the Chinese are everywhere. And a big part of why they're everywhere is making sure that countries don't pay attention to Taiwan. You know, they are absolutely punctilious about that. And the Taiwanese are pretty vigilant about also pushing back. So this is a game that, you know, that we're not paying enough attention to, both for our own interests and for Taiwan's interests. But I don't think the Taiwanese are as isolated as those numbers would suggest. And I think anybody who looks at what happened in Hong Kong and you look at the vibrancy of Taiwan's democracy, I think there's a real warning there as well, that no one should be neglecting Taiwan's democracy. At the same time, I think our own ambiguous policy, given the reality of China's strength, is also one. So it's something that lots of countries have to make decisions about. But Taiwan's democracy is certainly to be celebrated.
Yeah, and I think media experts are looking at the Taiwanese response to China's pretty heavy misinformation efforts and to see what lessons could be gleaned from that. And as we continue this year of epic elections worldwide and epic concerns over misinformation and AI and everything else. Well, that's our look at the wild world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. The state of New Hampshire holds presidential primaries for Democratic and Republican candidates. Ursula von der Leyen and Finnish PM Petteri Orpo visit Sweden for talks on EU relations. And member states of the Group of 77, remember that? Meet in Uganda for what's known as the Third South Summit.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. We appreciate the feedback. Also, tell us if you see any of those movies and what you think about them. If you'd like to reach out, please email us at twnw@cfr.org. The publications mentioned in this episode, as well as a transcript of our conversation, are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on cfr.org. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Sunetta Deuce, with Director of Podcasting Gabrielle Sierra, and engineered by Marcus Zacharia. Special thanks to Molly McEnany for her assistance. Our theme music is provided by Marcus Zacharia. And this is Carla Robbins saying so long.
And this is Bob McMahon saying goodbye, and be careful out there.